Hey, so what happened to the hole in the ozone layer?
I don't know. Is it still there? Should we be worried?
Yes and no and maybe. There's a lot of ways to answer that question. What do you know about the hole in the ozone layer?
Okay. I know that it was just like a pervasive fact of life in the background when I was a kid. In like kindergarten science, they were like, this is the earth. These are the plants. This is the hole in the ozone layer. It's going to kill us all.
Yeah, I definitely had a very similar experience. I thought it was either going to kill me or give me sunburn at the very least. But here's the thing. The story of the phrase, the hole in the ozone layer, a metaphor that potentially changed the world. That is a really interesting story. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. I'm Ian Steadman.
I'm Chiquita Pascal.
And this is This Will Change Your Mind, a show where we unpack how other people have changed your mind.
Yeah, there was something about that metaphor that was extremely effective.
So I've been looking into this. I've been looking into the hole in the ozone layer, the history of the hole in the ozone layer itself, and also the history of calling it a hole in the ozone layer, because it's not a hole and it's not a layer.
What?
Yeah.
We've been lied to?
Not lied so much as it's not really a distinct layer. It's just like the bit where there's the most ozone. There's only about 10 ozone molecules per every million of other molecule in the ozone layer. The other molecules are just air.
More like an ozone soup.
Yeah, or an ozone...
minestrone?
It's like, if you look back at how people talked about this, there was also this phrase, the ozone shield, because it is a shield. It protects us from ultraviolet radiation.
I mean, ozone shield, it's just... it sounds like nothing's getting through. Like, you're not messing with the ozone shield.
And if it wasn't for the ozone layer, we would all be, well, we wouldn't be dead as such. It's just we wouldn't have been born because, well, yeah, like if the Earth didn't have an ozone layer, life would not have been able to evolve out of the oceans and arrive on land. UV ultraviolet radiation would have just burned everything. It sterilizes bacteria. It's just bad news. 1985, you have the big reveal. You have three scientists, British scientists down in Antarctica. They discover the hole in the ozone layer. And very quickly, you have the hole in the ozone layer making headlines around the world. And this is the same year, 1985. There is this treaty that's signed. It's called the Vienna Convention for the Protection of the Ozone Layer. There's also this thing called the Montreal Protocol, which is like a sub-protocol of the Vienna Convention. And that is basically the framework that means that CFCs are not as much of a problem today, and the hole in the ozone layer is beginning to heal itself. It's still there. It's still a problem, but it's not getting worse and is healing. There's a 10-year period where we realized what was happening, we responded to it, passed a bunch of international law to regulate it, and people talk about it as this great success story.
The most amazing part of that story is that people across the world work together on a global level to actually affect a noticeable change in the environment. I feel like it just the contrast is really stark. So I wonder what was so special about that time or how leaders approached this problem that it got that outcome. Was this just like a relic of a particular period of time and we can never achieve this kind of unity again? What was their secret? Like, what was the special sauce that actually made us solve a problem?
So I figure that the metaphor is the secret sauce. The phrase hole in the ozone layer was coined in 1985, the same year that the hole itself was discovered. And that's interesting itself because it's 10 years before that. You already have countries and states in the US and other places banning or regulating CFCs. So this problem was already known about, but you get to 1985, they discover the hole, and then everywhere you look, hole in the ozone layer.
But who called it that? Was there like a consensus or a...
Here's the thing. No one knows.
What?
Yeah. So no, or at least nobody wants to take credit for it.
So it's like this authorless silver bullet.
Yeah. So I have spent a while trying to find this out. I've been asking around, checking up on some sources.
Doing the journalisming.
Yeah, exactly. So I figured I'd start with the British scientists who found it. They're on record saying they have no idea where it came from, and they explicitly say that they didn't come up with it. It wasn't their idea.
It wasn't me.
Yeah, one of them said, one of them, Joe Farman, he died in 2013, and he says that he thinks it was a journalist at the Washington Post, or maybe it was someone at NASA.
Some marketing intern, I bet. They're like, hey, we need a snappy phrase for this thinning of the ozone minestrone. And they were like, yeah.
So I went down this rabbit hole of trying to find out who the hell coined this phrase. I couldn't find the story in the Washington Post. I emailed the NASA press office and said, hey, is anybody still working there from 1985 who wants to claim credit for this? And got no response.
What, like you're like publisher's clearinghouse and you're going to give them like a prize of not money, just recognition on a podcast?
Yeah, just like a little line in Wikipedia, you know? I then reached out to some scientists who were looking at ozone around that time. One guy in particular, Pawan Basha, he's an atmospheric scientist and he's been at NASA since 1977. He told me he was partly responsible. So in 1985, he took the satellite data and he turned it into this graphic and he presented it at a conference in Prague. And those were the first images of the hole in the ozone layer that anyone ever saw. But he says, like, I didn't call it the hole in the ozone layer because it's not a hole, as all these scientists kept telling me. But he said he had a hunch about who was responsible because there was this colleague of his, a guy called Donald Heath, also a NASA scientist. There was a meeting in Salzburg shortly after this conference in Prague. Donald Heath set up this meeting. He took the images of the hole in the ozone layer into that meeting. And there were two people there who might have come up with it. There was this guy called Walter Sullivan, one of the most prominent American science journalists of the 20th century. And there was also Sherry Rowland. Sherry Rowland was the guy who in 1974, one of the two scientists who said, ozone might be an issue, guys. We should probably do something about this. So I spoke to Donald Heath and he said, yeah, it's probably Walter Sullivan. I don't think it was Sherry Rowland. I spoke to Sherry Rowland's daughter, Ingrid, and she was like, well, I asked my mom, she didn't know either, but my dad did have a talent for turns of phrase. Both of them are dead now, unfortunately, and we'll probably never know which the two of them was, but it sounds like it was probably the two of them, one of those two, or maybe they did it together.
So, all right, so you've gone on this wild goose chase to try to track down the person who so cleverly coined this phrase, the hole in the ozone layer, which in turn inspired the world to lose its freaking mind.
But it still kind of leaves a mystery, unfortunately, who did it. But it also leaves some bigger questions. The hole in the ozone layer phrase itself, we still don't know what the impact of that was exactly. Was it the secret sauce that meant that in the world we are in now, international cooperation to fix the environment seems so impossible? 30, 40 years ago, it was possible. It did happen. What role did a metaphor play in that? So to find out more, we spoke to someone who's actually studied the history of the hole in the ozone layer metaphor. His name's Sebastian Gresmel. He's a historian of science from Marie Curie University in Paris.
There is no hole in the ozone layer. There is never a complete destruction of all the ozone in the stratosphere. And also already the ozone layer is something like a metaphor because these are ozone molecules that are between 10 and 50 kilometers above our heads. And if you reduce the ozone layer to the pressure at ground level, then it's a tiny, tiny layer. It's as thick as a dime coin. It's difficult to grasp this idea outside of any metaphorical understanding, really.
It's true. Like, as you were saying that, I kept trying to imagine that, and all I could picture was just a hole.
It's true, yeah. So metaphors are quite important to do the job, to translate something that is really difficult to imagine. The basic science doesn't suggest something like a real hole, of course.
Yeah, but I think there's something about hole itself. I mean, if we could just sort of talk about the actual word here and sort of how the metaphor is composed, but that just very gut instinct level. If you're telling me that the blanket that is protecting me from being fried up has a hole in it, that makes me feel really existentially uneasy.
Yeah. And rightfully, because it is quite dangerous, it's good to have a metaphor that actually translates the immediate danger that an ozone hole poses.
So when was the first time ozone hole was used as a metaphor? Someone talked about a hole in the ozone layer.
Well, the first time that happened in the 1930s, that was a British mathematician and a geophysicist, Sidney Chapman. His idea was, maybe one could find an agent that destroys ozone, and by creating artificially short openings in the ozone layer, astronomers would be able to observe the spectrum of the light much better from the Earth.
Wait, they wanted to put a hole into the ozone layer?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Well, it was absolutely hypothetical, but it was the idea that, yeah, one could create, hypothetically, this ozone to have better astronomical observations.
Were they also planning to, like, get some sunscreen or something because of all the other rays that were going to get in, or they weren't really concerned with that? They were just like, let's
just worry about that later.
Well, they weren't so preoccupied about the possible environmental or health hazards that could be created. When you look at Chapman, he says, well, we probably would have to wear some hats, sun hats, and we have...
Wait, we would have to wear the hats?
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's worth it because you can make a hole and you could look through it and... What? Yeah,
exactly.
So what, wait, so could... just understand. So you want to make a hole in the ozone layer because it would make it easier to do astronomical observations.
Yeah, when we look at different planets, stars, etc., we often look at the light emitted from these distant places that arrives at the Earth, and the ozone layer also absorbs a part of that.
So this is just a kind of hypothetical thing.
Yes.
Did this idea stick around? Did anyone kind of pick it up and run with it?
Now, in the astronomical community, it didn't stick around very long. And of course, it was just considered as a hypothetical exercise in what would be possible.
Did it stick around in any way as a piece of language, or did it kind of disappear for a while and reoccur?
So Chapman was during the 1930s, and then the Second World War, as we all know, preoccupied in the scientists in many other ways. So during the 1950s, during the Cold War, the metaphor reappeared again.
This is ominous. During the Cold War?
Yeah. Then we have a geostrategic and military interest in the ozone hole. When you think about it, an ozone hole makes a tremendously good weapon, because if you could create artificially over enemy territory an ozone hole, that could incapacitate crop production, it can incapacitate the people and potentially the soldiers there, and
what?
So on. So
that is sinister.
Yeah, it is very sinister. The debate shifted quite a lot with, I would say, the debate on supersonic transportation. When one first intended to build the Concorde, the Russians built the Tupolev, and Boeing intended to build also a supersonic transportation fleet. That's when one started in the 60s to look into the possible environmental effects, in particular to ozone. So, and that's where the first phase of the ozone research got quite political. That's the first debate on ozone destruction, really, that was engaged in the public sphere.
How did that first debate move into what became the, I guess, the mid-80s debate, which is what I think for us is definitely the most memorable ozone debate, not least because we're too young to live through the first one.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
During the 70s, before the ozone hole discovery, there were already individual actions taken. There was a pre-ozone hole encouragement already, environmentalists encouraging not to use certain products, etc. But the real shift that happened with the ozone hole was that also industry changed trajectory and said, we want to get onto the boat before it's too late, before there is a legislation that will tell us we can't produce CFCs anymore. It came, of course, because there was also a lot of pressure from environmentalists saying that CFCs are highly dangerous substances and that we have to get rid of them.
When it comes to those activists and environmental groups, how useful was the ozone hole metaphor as an icon? Is maybe the word I'm looking for here, like an icon of this problem?
Yeah, it's like an icon. You can use it on pamphlets and so on. You can use it as a visual strategy to easily pass a message that is, of course, a highly catastrophist.
I don't want to give a metaphor too much credit, as much as it played a role. You know, systemic change takes more than just a clever phrase. But do you think that the fact that there isn't climate change or global warming as phrases, they're not as clear and threatening, maybe, or like they're just not as easy to visualize as something like the hole in the ozone layer?
Absolutely. The ozone hole is the single global environmental catastrophe that didn't happen the way it could have happened if we would have continued with business as usual. Actually, and that because the Montreal Protocol and the Vienna Convention and the Montreal Protocol were signed universally that we have a real success story. And that success story, of course, one would like to reproduce that with climate change today, but it is very hard because the issues are quite different here, of course.
But what was the actual impact of the metaphor?
I believe it had a strong impact on the political process that led to the signing of the Montreal Protocol. The chief negotiator for the United States, Benedict, he said they tried to not take into account of the new findings on the ozone hole, of the images of NASA and so on. I don't think that it's quite something one can ignore, the findings from Antarctica, that they just could have ignored something like an ozone hole as an immediate threat. One didn't know all the causes of the actual hole creation in Antarctica. One didn't have already all the scientific evidence. Let's say the precautionary principle prevailed over always the call for hard scientific evidence one needs, etc.
So this raises the question, how do you make a decision, a big policy decision, under conditions of scientific uncertainty?
We're dying to know.
I'm Karen Litvin. I'm professor of political science and environmental studies at the University of Washington in Seattle.
How useful was it having a metaphor like the hole in the ozone layer? It's not really accurate, but how useful a metaphor was that when it came to this kind of political action?
It was a very useful metaphor. Let's talk about the width of this hole. It's over 3,000 miles wide. So yes, maybe it's a kind of exaggeration, but not really. We don't see Antarctica. We don't see ozone. We don't see any of this. So you can see this happening on these images. And so that was really important, as having images and having language that could convey the gravity of the situation. There's a lot of tension within the Reagan administration over this because this is the first time really since World War II that you had a government elected with the explicit policy of basically getting rid of government as much as possible. Now, that sounds normal to us now, but in 1980, that was new. And so the Secretary of the Interior at that time, Donald Hodel, he suggested that rather than having international law take care of the ozone layer, what we should have is a policy of personal protection. And the personal protection policy would be that you wear sunscreen and sun hats. That's personal protection. We don't need government to get involved in this. And so environmentalists just got on board with that, and they made such wonderful political hay of it. They had a press conference where they had fish dressed up in sunglasses and cows dressed up with sun hats and, you know, making the point that it's not just us, you know. So in the late 80s, early 90s, I interviewed most of the main scientists who were involved with the ozone treaties, but they felt that they needed to be cautious and not recommend to policymakers that they do anything drastic about CFCs because they didn't know. Interestingly, it was the U.S. that took the lead on this treaty. By 1985, 86, the Reagan administration was now on its third EPA head. And the guy who came in, Lee Thomas, you know, he was conservative, but he was also science oriented. And I had one of my most interesting interviews with him. I asked him, so what did you actually think, even though the science wasn't in, what did you actually think? He said, well, I thought it was most likely the CFCs that were destroying the ozone layer. And so the only thing that I could really recommend in good conscience is that we move away from those chemicals. And so the U.S. position was a 95% cutback, but his feeling was on something this big, better safe than sorry. The studies after that were to figure out basically how deep could the destruction of the ozone layer go. This little British Antarctic survey come up with 50% thinning of the Antarctic ozone layer. And so it was called a hole. It was dramatic thinning, let's call it that.
It's the difference between baldness and thinning.
And language matters. Politically, language matters. When scientists are accurate about what they're talking about, if they said dramatic thinning, even dramatic, that's not really a scientific term. If they said 50% thinning, that doesn't carry the same oomph to it as ozone hole.
And it also seems, you know, it conjures this image of things like oxygen leaking out of the earth, or, I don't know, space aliens getting in. Like, I mean, to a little kid in the 90s, hearing about this hole in the ozone layer was like really distressful for me.
Yeah, we were both children at that time, and it was a huge thing being told that there was a hole in the ozone layer and having this sense of like, if I walked outside on the wrong day, the hole might be over me that day. And I might get...
Oh my God, you too? I thought I was the only one. It makes sense in terms of how we confronted, you know, the issue of ozone politically and socially and scientifically. And I guess it's sort of bringing into play some of the dynamic about politicians and scientists and the language around that. Sort of, it almost sounds like a pilot program, if you will, for like the real main event here, which seems to be climate change.
Yeah, I mean, there's lessons to be learned. You know, a lot of people believe that international action is meaningless and international law doesn't have teeth and it doesn't work. And actually, international law, by and large, has worked. We have saved the ozone layer. And of course, that could still not be true in the future. There's a black market and CFCs. There's all kinds of possibilities for wrecking that treaty system. But it is in place, and it has been since 1987. I think that the big lesson of just the possibilities of international law when there's a sense of a common goal. I think on climate change, global warming, well, you know, we always like it when it's a little bit cozier and warmer, so that's not so threatening. And climate change sounds like, oh, well, some change is good and some change isn't, you know. The word that would be the most accurate and also the most alarming would be climate destabilization. Then coming back to how you perceived it as a child, you know, in some ways you had the right orientation, which was, oh my God, this should not be happening.
like
you didn't know, you know, anything about DuPont or the chemical companies or the Montreal Protocol or anything like that. But there just sounds like, wait a minute, the grown-ups shouldn't be letting this happen.
This is one of the few stories that we've told this season that actually makes me feel kind of hopeful.
Yeah. Something it really reminds me of is plastic straws.
Okay. Say more about that.
Okay. There's this wave happening where people and businesses and companies and even some governments are saying, okay, no, you can't have plastic bags or you can't have plastic straws because of plastic in the oceans. But it's like, it's here and there. It's not comprehensive. It's not like this massive, complete change of how we use plastic. Back when there was still a lot of controversy and debate about whether to regulate CFCs and how to protect the ozone, it sounds like the ozone problem was in the same sort of situation. A lot of people weren't buying aerosols anymore because they'd heard that it was a problem and they were going to do something about it. But you didn't have this large systemic solution yet. But that actually happened. And they passed this international treaty that did actually start to fix the problem. So it is kind of inspiring. Like there is something encouraging there. So the question, I guess, is you're not going to solve plastic pollution or you're not going to solve climate change, like something as big as climate change with just a metaphor, but it wouldn't hurt and it might actively still help.
Do you have any like metaphors that you've thought about while you've been diving so deeply into this?
Well, no.
That's fine. We can stop where you stop. That's great.
Thanks so much for listening to This Will Change Your Mind, part of the Diffusion Network. Our theme song is Document Swell by Rainforestation, and the other music you've heard throughout the episode is from the album The Illusion is Worth Fighting For by King's Tux. The title track is playing right now. Our producer is Sarah Miles, and you can find out more about us and the show on the website, thiswillchangeyourmind.com. You can also see just how deep my dive was into the origins of that hole in the ozone layer metaphor. If you're listening and you haven't subscribed already, that's fine, we won't hold it against you, but you can find us on all your favourite podcast portals like iTunes, and if you enjoyed the show, then leaving a review there is one of the best ways you can help us out. We'd really appreciate it. In the next episode, we're going to be looking at emotions Half a century ago, a scientist came up with a theory that everyone in the world experiences only six, that's right, six emotions, and we all experience them the same way. That theory has been challenged and overturned since, but its legacy lives on all around us. See you then.